listening to Truth Quest with Melody, and this is KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9, Salida, Colorado. And I've got a special guest this evening, Bruce Gagnon, and I brought back my great co-host, Eric Carlstrom, a professor of geography at California State University at Stanislaus, with nearly 30 years of teaching experience. And his academic research is focused on ancient soils and paleosols, landforms as a means of reconstructing climates and environmental conditions of the past. And again, we're streamed on the internet at khen.org, and TruthQuest programs are archived at www.gimmesometruth.info. And I also want to mention that if you want to catch any of Eric's past work, it's at www.naturalclimatechange.us. And Water Watch Alliance, you can type that into Google. And if you have any questions for the program, you can type in khen.dj@gmail.com. And I also want to mention next week, my mind just went blank again as if, who's our guest next week, and I'll think of it a little bit later here. I'll pull it up. But and I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and are my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And in 1971, Bruce, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, and I've got you there too, Eric. And in 1971, soon after graduating from high school, Bruce volunteered for the U.S. Air Force, and because he wanted to be a career military man, he like his dad, but he flunked his induction physical because of an old football injury and had to get a waiver to get into the military. And so he was, after his training, was sent to Travis Air Force Base in California. That was an airlift base for the war in Vietnam, and soldiers would come to the base from all over the country to fly to Vietnam, and when the planes returned, they carried the body bags of those who'd been killed in the war.
Melody, could you speak up just a little bit? I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Okay, here.
That's better when you speak right into it, yeah.
Okay. All right. And so and as most weekends, he would protest, and which protests would be held outside the gates of a base by the peace movement. And Bruce would be threatened by the Air Force authorities that they were not going to go near the protest or they would be severely disciplined. This this created a debate in the barracks, and as it turned out, and his first roommate was one of the leading organizers of the GI anti-war resistance movement. And at night, guys would come into the room and talk about the war for hours. Having grown up a young conservative from a military family, this was all new to Bruce, and it ended up changing his life. And after 6 months, he became a peace activist. Bruce, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Wow, you got that down pretty good. Well, that's the story. That's the true story, and it just goes to show, I think, a couple of important things. One is that, you know, we're often trash talking about right wing conservatives. You know, we speak very badly of them. When I got out of the Air Force and was going to college, I was recruited to become an organizer of farm workers in Florida for the United Farm Workers Union, Cesar Chavez's union. And Cesar used to frequently tell the staff, you know, or ask the staff when he would hear them trash talking about the workers, and he would say, "What makes you think that any worker wants to ever follow you if they heard the way you talk about them?" And I think we have to think about how many opportunities there are to bring conservatives like I was along. But if they hear us calling them names the way we often do, stupid and illiterate and other such things, they might not be so inclined to follow us. I was treated very, very respectfully by the guys in the military, that were in the peace movement, even though I was a right-wing conservative. And they brought me along and changed my life, and I'm forever indebted to them. But the second lesson from that time is that just a few people holding signs outside a military base, usually no more than a dozen at a time, can really create a lot of debate inside of a base. In our case, we had 15,000 troops permanently assigned to our base, in addition to the many thousands that came and went on the airplane. So, you know, it's one of those kind of things you can't easily quantify and qualify, but I know from my own personal experience that a public protest is absolutely essential if we hope to change anything in America, especially if we hope to change other people's hearts and minds.
I just want to also mention that you've spoke internationally and you've written for publications such as the Earth Island Journal, Counterpunch, Z Magazine, Space News, National Catholic Reporter, Asian Times, Le Monde Diplomatique, and Canadian Dimension, and you produced couple of videos, Arsenal of Hypocrisy and Battle for America's Soul, and you have a book, Come Together Right Now, Organizing Stories for a Fading Empire, and you also host The Issue, a cable TV program that airs in 5 communities in Maine, your home state. Eric, do you want to go ahead and carry on here, and let me see if I can play with some of these dials.
Wait, Melody, can you speak up?
Do you want to go ahead and talk to Bruce here, and I'll mess with the dials here on this.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, we definitely. I would like to express my thanks for Bruce for joining us tonight. My experience of Bruce and his work dates back to probably 2004, 2005, when there were a series of independent investigations into 911, and Bruce, I think, was invited as a speaker at the San Francisco International 911 investigation, at which time, you know, it became clear that he had done a lot of work on this idea of the topic of weaponization of space. At that point, I bought his video, Arsenal of Hypocrisy, and so we're very interested to kind of learn some of the things that he knows on those topics. So maybe I can just start off asking you, Bruce, to kind of give us an idea of your experience with this issue and maybe sum up some of the main issues that you think are facing us as a country as a result of this push forward towards the complete domination of space.
Well, I first began working on space issues in 1982. Actually, I remember the exact date, June 12, 1982. I was living in Orlando, Florida, and on that particular day, there was a massive protest in New York City around the United Nations special session on disarmament. Almost 1 million people were there. I watched the rally speakers on C-SPAN TV, and after it was over, C-SPAN switched to a right-wing conference where the speaker was Lieutenant General Daniel Graham, who was at that time Ronald Reagan's head of SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative. And after his speech in the Q&A, someone said, "General Graham, they say there's almost 1 million people protesting in New York City today against nuclear weapons. Aren't you worried?" And he said, "No, I think it's fantastic. They're out there protesting against ICBMs, and we're moving into space. We're moving our operations into space, and they don't have a clue, so let them keep doing what they're doing." So it was in that moment that I actually began to work on space issues, and I've been doing it ever since. We created the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space in 1992, 10 years later. But in the interim, first 10 years, I was working for the Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice and taking people over and over again to the space program for protests when they were launching military satellites or testing various systems from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, or they were launching plutonium into space, something that the nuclear industry has been promoting for a long time. So the bottom line, though, today is that all warfare on the Earth is coordinated by space technology. So when the U.S. launched the shock and awe invasion of Iraq in 2003, in the initial attack, 70% of the weapons were guided to their targets by space satellites. And so today the United States has an incredible array of military satellites in space that are coordinating and directing all of its military operations on the ground, flying the drones over Afghanistan and Pakistan, the GIs busting down doors in Iraq or Afghanistan in the middle of the night when they pull people, innocent civilians, out of their homes. Inside of their Humvees, they're hooked up to the satellites with these maps, street maps of virtually anywhere you want to look at on the Earth, they have them. So everything they do today is coordinated and directed by military satellites. And the Pentagon is saying, well, we have to control and dominate space and deny other countries access to space. So they say, therefore, we can't allow another country like Russia or China or any other competitor to have that same access. And so the U.S. is now working on offensive anti-satellite systems that would allow the U.S. to take out other countries' satellites. And at the same time, one of the latest trends in military space is this whole idea of cyberspace or cyber warfare, where you would essentially use your computer as a weapon to crawl inside your enemy's computer systems so that you can shut down their ability to defend themselves, to see you coming after them in your first strike attack. It was first field tested during the Yugoslavia war when Clinton was president, when the U.S. actually used its military computers to crawl inside of Yugoslavia's computer systems, shut down its self-defense system, and so that when U.S. and NATO bombers went in and blew the hell out of Yugoslavia, they had no defense against it. So all of these trends are operating now, and in general I would say that Obama has been a great gift for the military-industrial complex. He's either continued most of Bush's programs or expanded and even gone further in others. At the same time, he's demobilized the left across the country, not only the peace movement, but all the movements. He's demobilized them with his great rhetoric. But as we've now seen after 2 years, he's been a sellout on every significant progressive issue in the country.
Just to kind of go back and pick up on some of the events of the past few decades, which you kind of briefly went over. As I recall, as an academic, in the 1980s, there was an enormous amount of federal grant money available for those who are interested in doing research on Star Wars. And, of course, Reagan, gave the push to this idea with his kind of simplistic, almost childlike vision, which he expressed on TV, that, wouldn't it be nice if we had some kind of a shield to protect our country from Russian intercontinental ballistic missiles, and, shouldn't we put our best scientists on this? And which, of course, I don't think is really what they were doing, because everybody knows that I think that money, which was billions of dollars, was used in a program which involved the militarization of space. So could you kind of give us some of the your perception of some of the projects that got going about that time?
Before you guys go any further, I just want to make sure, can you hear me now on the sound levels? Are you hearing me, Eric and Bruce?
I can hear you a little better, Melody.
Okay, and how about you, Bruce?
I can hear you. It's low, but
it's low. Okay,
it's low, Melody. But now I can hear you. Before, I couldn't hear you.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Well, you know, the important thing, to, I think, that I've learned over all these years is not to get hung up on any particular one or two technologies, because the Pentagon admits, they're the first to admit that they work on many, many, many different technologies. I'm talking space weapons technologies. And they don't expect the majority of them ever to work. But what happens is they're investing massive amounts of money in research and development. And each leg, each new program, each new testing program bears some level of fruit that they use to build on and go on to make new whole new systems. And so I hear a lot of people saying, oh, well, that stuff will never work, don't worry about it, blah, blah, blah. But I think they're making a strategic mistake when they say that, because what we've seen is these scientists are brilliant. They can land rovers on Mars and drive them around. You know, they're outfitted with nuclear power, with plutonium, you know. So these guys are geniuses, let's be honest about it. And you give them enough time and you give them enough money and they will come up with new technologies. Right now they're testing laser systems that can be fired from the Earth into space to knock out a satellite. That they're working on laser systems on board Boeing 747s, what they call the airborne laser, that would be able to take out other countries' nuclear weapons. After you hit them first in a first strike, they try to fire their retaliatory capability. You have this plane flying around, it fires a laser. So they're working on many different things at once. They're working on right now the military space plane, the successor to the shuttle, that would fly from one end of the Earth through space to the other end of the planet in 1 hour or less, and be used in a first strike attack. In fact, the Space Command, U.S. Space Command, has been annually wargaming a first strike attack on China, set in the year 2016, and the first weapon that is used is the military space plane that flies down from space, drops a devastating attack on China's nuclear forces. They have about 20 nuclear missiles capable of hitting the west coast of the United States. And so the U.S. tries to take them out in this first strike attack war game. And then China gets a few of their missiles fired in a retaliatory strike. And that's when these so-called missile defense systems that are now being deployed in Taiwan. Obama has allowed the sale of these missile defense systems, although we call them missile offense systems, to Taiwan, that is really charging China up, as you can imagine. The U.S. is deploying them in Japan and South Korea, and on ships, Navy ships, Aegis destroyers, just off the coast of mainland China. So all of this is being done to give the U.S. this first-strike system that would be, again, directed by space satellites, and some of it would operate from and through and space as well. So many, many other technologies are now being developed on top of this, too.
We have talked to people recently on this show about weather warfare, the militarization of the skies in that sense, which may have to do with putting directed energy wavelengths of extremely low frequencies and radio waves, et cetera, bouncing them off the ionosphere, et cetera, ionospheric heaters, the so-called HARP facility, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, which apparently uses some Tesla technologies that go back. Now, to what extent do you consider the HARP facility to be part of the weaponization of space that you're looking at?
Well, you know, when you're the HARP is a directed energy weapon where they're firing it into the ionosphere in order to lift the ionosphere to interfere with global communications and also to change weather, to use weather modification as a battlefield weapon. I'm absolutely convinced that they're doing that, and there's quite a well-known website called Weather as a Force Multiplier, Owning the Weather in 2025. If you just Google that, Weather as a Force Multiplier, Owning the Weather in 2025, it's a particular research paper presented to the Air Force, and in it they talk about these things. They talk about the exploitation of near space for space control. They talk about modification of the near space environment being crucial to battle space dominance, a modification of the ionosphere to enhance or disrupt communications has recently become the subject of active research, the study says. So there's no doubt in my mind that they're doing all these things. And I would use one word in particular to describe these activities, and it is evil, because what you have here is the militarist and the scientist thinking that they are literally God. They have the power of God to mess around with God's creation, if you will. And I think when you start lifting the ionosphere, trying to change weather, you set in motion ripple effects that have devastating impacts on our Mother Earth. And I think it's no coincidence that everywhere I go today when I travel, one of the first things people tell me is how their weather patterns, their normal weather patterns for their particular part of the world, are totally out of whack, totally screwed up. And I think these are all these kind of changes that we're seeing are in part, on some level, being caused by these military weather modification experiments. You know, just in the last couple of days, we've seen this story hit the newspapers, the mainstream newspapers, about the Nazi operatives that were brought over to America after World War II. And so we know that, and I talked about this, as you know, in The Arsenal of Hypocrisy, the film, that 1,500 of the top Nazi scientists were brought to the U.S. after World War II to create the space program, to create the CIA. Nazi intelligence were brought over to create the CIA. The LSD drug experiments in the 60s, where people were jumping out of windows, those were the Nazi scientists that were doing those things, the MK Ultra mind control program. And so all of these really absolutely sick and evil programs in some way have been linked to those Nazi 1,500 Nazi scientists that came over to this country after the war was over. Now, some years ago, just a few years ago, a reporter with the Bible of the military-industrial complex, it's called Jane's Defense Weekly, one of their reporters wrote a book about this whole question of what level of ideological contamination was there when the Nazis were brought over to America. They brought with them the black budget, Hitler's secret black budget that we have today, that the Congress is not even allowed to know how money is being spent on these high-tech research and development programs. And his conclusion was that there has been a massive ideological contamination within the military-industrial complex by these Nazi operatives. So I think these weather modification schemes and messing around with the ionosphere are all extensions of this whole Nazi program, Nazi militarism, global military takeover program that they brought to this country when they were brought here after World War II.
Would you say, Bruce, and this is an interesting line that I haven't heard too many people speak about, but I have a book called The Nazi Hydra in America, which traces a lot of these connections. Would you say that for some of these individuals, that the Third Reich lives on through the United States?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I got to tell you, a couple years ago, I was watching C-SPAN one evening, and I listened as Thomas Barnett was introduced to a big auditorium full of high-level military brass and CIA people. And he was introduced as Donald Rumsfeld's strategy guy. This was during the Bush administration when Rumsfeld was Secretary of War. And he went on to do a three-hour presentation basically laying out where the U.S. is going militarily, what's our strategy as part of corporate globalization. And his main point was that we're not going to have jobs in America anymore. It's going to be cheaper to move jobs overseas by the corporations. They can maximize profits. And that America's role under corporate globalization, every different country is going to have a different job, he said. America's role will be security export, endless war. And in that conversation, he said the following. Adolf Hitler never had to ask permission to invade another country, and neither will we. So it's absolutely real, what you just said, that there's no doubt about it that we have become the Nazi blitzkrieg operation, and with the same objectives, global domination. And fascism is always defined, Mussolini anyway, defined fascism as the wedding of government and corporate power. And that is exactly what we have in America today.
Well, you know, a lot of people noticed in 2003 when the United States preemptively invaded Iraq in violation of international law, the Geneva Convention, the Nuremberg Trials, and the United Nations Charter, that we were doing pretty much exactly what Hitler did when he invaded Poland at the beginning of World War II to seize the coal fields, etc. So it would appear that the Bush administration has just gone ahead with the program without asking anybody's permission, as you mentioned.
Yeah, and now they seize the oil fields, and Obama is continuing the same operation. So. I think that's where we are today, and I think that one of the great difficulties for many people on the left is to end their illusions, you know, that we're still living in a democracy, that you know we still can reform this this juggernaut, and I don't see it that way at all. I think we have to talk about resistance, active and public resistance to this fascist military dictatorship that we have today.
Just to kind of give some background, which is probably no news to you, Bruce, but I've got some. I've looked into this document, as you mentioned, 2025, the Air Force document of 1996, called "Weather as a Force Multiplier: Owning the Weather in 2025," and I've come up with some quotes that show that this is not a new idea. Apparently, Lyndon Baines Johnson, our previous president, said, control of space means control of the world. From space, the masters of infinity would have the power to control the Earth's weather, to cause drought and flood, to change the tides and raise the levels of the sea, to divert the Gulf Stream and change temperature climates to frigid. In other words, bring on another ice age. Mm-hmm. We
That's
do see that being
quote.
Played out now, don't we?
That's a very powerful quote, absolutely. Let me just take a moment and recommend that if people are interested in learning more about all this or seeing the videos that we have on all these topics, they can go to our website, which is spaceforpeace.org, spaceforpeace.org.
And I would just want to say this is Bruce Gagnon, and who is head of the, are you the head of or the starter of the global?
Coordinator.
Coordinator, okay.
Yeah, and co-founder, yeah.
Okay, of Global Network for Peace.
No.
Wait, did I say that
global
wrong?
Global Network against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space.
I'm sorry, I'm doing this without any notes in front of me.
One more time, I'm sorry, Global Network for...
No. A global network against weapons and nuclear power in space.
Okay. Yeah.
I've got it here.
spaceforpeace.org.
Yeah. Spaceforpeace.org. You were mentioning earlier, Bruce, just before we started, that there is a new video or DVD out now, which you recommended, called Pax Americana and the Weaponization of Space. Now, were you involved in that?
Yeah, I was interviewed extensively, as was two of our other board members from the Global Network. It's done by a filmmaker who lives in Spain, but he's French-Canadian, and his name is Dennis Delestrac. And if you go just Google Pax Americana, you should find it very quickly, and there's a trailer on the website and information about the film. It's been shown on public television already in Canada and Germany and France and Belgium, and it's been appearing in theaters in Latin America and really all Africa, all over the world, except not in the United States. He's having trouble finding a distribution deal in the United States. So far, no one is interested in distributing the film in the U.S., so he's having a hard time getting it out in the U.S., but it's being seen all over the world already by multiple millions of people, and it's a great film, and really a very strong documentary, and really, I think, updates very well things today from the earlier film we did, Arsenal of Hypocrisy.
Bruce, is it available on the Internet at all?
No,
okay.
not at all. People can get a copy. He's allowed me to make copies and sell them to people just to get it out there in the U.S. And I can, if people send me $15 to the Global Network, and the address is on our website at spaceforpeace.org, I can send people a copy of it.
Okay, I will do that. I'd certainly like to see that. I'll do that. Now, the title of that thing includes Pax Americana. For those who are listening and who haven't heard that term before, that goes back to the term Pax Romana, the idea of a peace imposed by the Roman Empire, and the equivalent would be the world peace imposed by, say, the American Empire. And that term was also used in a document called Rebuilding America's Defenses, which was authored by Dick Cheney's group, I think around the year 2000, and associated with a think tank called Project for a New American Century, which more or less gave George Bush II his entire agenda for his administration for both terms. So this idea is a military concept, the idea of enforcing 100 years of American domination over the planet. Is that how you would perceive that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And he starts the film out inside the chapel at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs with the minister giving a sermon about that very thing. And really, you know, speaking about the joys of Pax Americana, so it's very chilling, bone-chilling beginning in the film. And it, actually, the first 20 minutes of the film, it's about a 90-minute film documentary. And the first 20 minutes, he got really amazing access into the bowels of the military-industrial complex, you know, the aerospace industry. And he basically gives their whole line the first 20 minutes, so you really get a dose of the rhetoric and the brainwashing and everything else that they're doing. And then he proceeds to deconstruct, you know, their whole story the rest of the film. So, I think it's a really powerful documentary. It won the best documentary award at a film festival outside of Vancouver already.
So just to follow up on that idea a little bit, that you know, there are individuals, perhaps the majority of the individuals who are involved with the military-industrial complex for their livelihood, they may have some idealism that this is good, that this is going to bring world peace, that peace through strength and all this stuff. Can you kind of deconstruct that mindset for us a little bit?
Well, you know, he kind of features one student, one cadet at the Air Force Academy throughout the film, and he kind of uses him as a leading character. And that's exactly what this kid is saying. This is what he's been taught, you know, that, that you know, we're the good guys and we need this stuff and everything else. But, you know, the point is that we're creating a new arms race, and that every step of the way we're leading now, pushing this new arms race into space that is going to be massively expensive. The Pentagon has long bragged that the Star Wars program will be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth. And so where are you going to get the money to pay for that? Well, we're now seeing it. They're going after Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. They're going what they call the entitlement programs. They're now moving to defund them and move that money into the military-industrial complex to pay for these very expensive programs. And then on top of that, these things are destabilizing. When you start surrounding, excuse me, as we are today, Russia and China militarily, and then on top of that, putting in the layer of space technology that we are, you create the desire on the part of those countries to respond. And they are. They have to. And not only them, but even our partners, the Europeans, have created their own military space satellite program called Galileo because they fear a U.S., you know, Pax Americana. So, you know, back if we go back again to the Yugoslavia war when NATO was our partner, after that war was over, the Europeans were complaining in publications like Aviation Week and Space Technology, saying that here they were, their NATO planes were flying bombing raids over Yugoslavia, but the United States would not give them any of the satellite imagery of what they were hitting or not hitting when they dropped their bombs, and so they had no clue. And so they came out of that war saying this will never happen again. And then they embarked on creating their own military space reconnaissance satellite system, Galileo. So even the Europeans don't feel like they can rely on the United States having sole control, being the master of space. So now we're seeing China respond. Russia is, as their economy has begun to recover, they're responding again as well.
Wouldn't the NATO countries feel like they were part of the team, you might say, of the United States in this?
I'm sorry, say that again?
The NATO countries.
Yeah.
Wouldn't they all feel like they're part of the same side, and so they wouldn't need to... there are certainly NATO countries in Europe. By virtue of being in NATO, wouldn't they feel protected?
Well, you know, they have common interest. They want to control the oil flow. They want to control declining resources on the planet. Their corporations want to control them. But they also have a bit of a distrust of the United States' intentions now and then. And so they're hedging their bets. And sometimes the interests are similar and they work together, but sometimes they're not. And so I think that's what we're seeing. I think that really there are a few countries around the world that really trust the United States of America.
Bruce, I find that we've got a number of people that have come back home that have been heavily involved in those NATO. I mean, they were part of NATO. Do you find that there's kind of a conflict of interest going on, or do they feel like they're just part of the American forces? Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, a lot of them worked as maybe training mercenaries, and they're coming back here and being involved in training, continuing that training with various troops. Are you following what I'm saying?
Barely.
Barely?
I'm not sure it's clear to me.
Well, I've run into several different sheriffs and law enforcement who have been, I wasn't aware of it much before, but until I saw some of these people that had been involved in training troops over in Yugoslavia and Bosnia and Serbia and those areas, and then coming back here and still being involved as trainers over here with NATO troops. And that they ran for, some of them have become sheriffs, and it isn't just, you know, we've got one in our area, but there, I've run across that in other areas as well. And that's, I'm just bringing that out. I don't know any correlation or whatever, but I'm noticing that.
Well, you know, again, I think that there's often mixed reasons why people become allies. In the case of the war in Afghanistan, I think a lot of NATO countries want to be involved in it because the war is really about which direction the Caspian Sea oil and natural gas pipelines are going to be routed. Are they going to go through Russia? Are they going to go through Iran? Are they going to go east through China? Or are they going to go south through Afghanistan and Pakistan? That's why we're in, that's why we're there today, making war in those countries. So, you know, so in some NATO countries, you know, or most NATO countries, you know, want to be on the winning side of deciding which direction those pipelines are going to be routed. But on the other hand, back home, the public in those countries is very much opposed to their participation in that war, and some of their leaders have are a bit skeptical about you know, whether it's going to be successful and how long they should remain. And so, you know, there's a lot of mixed metaphors involved here, if you will.
Well, one of the topics that I was interested in exploring with you a little bit is the chemtrails. Some people believe that this has to do with the militarization of space, that it has to do with putting particulates or chemicals in the atmosphere that can therefore be, that can then be affected by these electromagnetic wavelengths that are sent out by HAARP and other facilities, and that this may have a role certainly it's in occurring in all NATO countries, but it seems to be occurring in just about all the countries of the world. Do you have a take on what's going on with that, Bruce?
Well, you know, there's very little specific information available as to what chemtrails are really about. There's a lot of speculation. There's a lot of theorizing. There's some good guessing, but I've yet to see any, you know, definitive answers. But I've seen chemtrails myself. I've seen an entire sky over Albuquerque, New Mexico, when I was at a protest, an all-day protest on one occasion, protesting against a conference of nuclear, space nuclear power people. And I saw the entire sky created into like a spider web of these chemtrails. So I believe in it. I believe it's happening. I've seen lots of pictures of them, too. We have some things in our website about it as well. I think chemtrails are about weather modification. I think they're about testing this whole global communication system. So, you know, I think, like HAARP, it has many different, chemtrails have many different uses, if you will. But I am definitely a believer that it's happening and that it's not good, and that that it's having negative effects on our health, because when you have these chemicals drifting down from the sky, we're breathing them in. You know, it's getting into our water. It's getting into our environment. And so it's got to be having a tremendous impact on our health as well as the health of the planet. So, again, we can't get any answers from any of this. Congress, I've heard of numbers of people who have tried to get information from Congress, and they get no response. They get no information. They're told that it's not happening. There's no such thing. So clearly, when you see that kind of obstruction of information, you know that there's something real there.
It reminds me of the kind of stonewalling that we have seen by Congress, except for just a couple members, on the issue of 911. Are you familiar with Dr. Judy Wood, Bruce, and her concept or her research that she believes shows that the World Trade Center towers came down through amongst other things, and principally through directed energy weapons?
Oh no, I haven't seen that.
Well, she's got a website called drjudywood.com, and we have interviewed her on this show once. She's a materials engineering professor, or former materials engineering professor, and has done a tremendous amount of research using the photograph. And with her knowledge of how materials work and everything, she came to the conclusion that it was directed energy weapons that brought those towers down at the speed of gravity. And so I have always in the back of my mind thought that there is a link between the militarization of space, HAARP, 911, and weather warfare, and that there is an array of Pentagon technologies, you might call it in the black or black budget type stuff, that involves these extremely powerful usages of directed energy weapons. Is that something that you've looked into as a... you know, somebody's interested in this topic?
Well, I'll check out her website. That's the first I've ever heard of that. I've been following the work of the engineers and architects for 9/11 Truth. I think that's the name of their
Richard
group.
Gage?
Yes. And
yeah.
I've been very impressed with their work. And I think it's been fairly conclusive that they've made a very strong case that the towers were laced with high explosives and brought down in controlled demolition style. In the end, however it was done, it was certainly done, and it was certainly used as a pretext to then get us into these endless wars. And I always go back to the book by Zbigniew Brzezinski, written long before 9/11, called The Grand Chessboard, where in his book he talks about the importance of controlling the Central Asian region, what he calls Eurasia, because of, again, the Caspian Sea oil and natural gas. And he has charts and graphs where he lays out the pipeline routes that the oil corporations really want, and in that book he says that this would be a massively expensive military operation to control this region, and one that the American people would not likely support because of the expense and the implications for defunding things like public education and health care and Social Security and Medicare and all that stuff. But he goes on to say that only with a Pearl Harbor-like event would the American people be, brought along. And, of course, that's what happened on 9/11. And we saw the same language in the PNAC documents, the Project for New American Century, that many of the Bush administration people were members of. So I think what you have here is a conjunction of interest, both with the Republicans from PNAC and then the Democrats, that Zbigniew Brzezinski, he was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor. He was one of the people that discovered Obama when he was a student at Columbia University and helped develop and nurture his campaign for president. So I think that what we have today is the clear example of this coup d'etat that has happened in this country, where the interests of the oligarchy are in charge of both parties and coming forward with these policies that are getting us into endless war without any debate, without any discussion, without any real agreement by the American people that they want to, you know, attack other countries and have endless war and spend $8 billion a month like we are today in Afghanistan and then have to destroy social progress as a result. So clearly we have a country that is now being run by basically the CIA and the corporations.
Yeah, we totally agree on that. But just to kind of underscore the point on the directed energy weapons, or at least as a possibility, Dr. Judy Webb's website is drjudywood.com. And she convinced me, we interviewed her, and her, our website, our interview with her, are in the archives of Melody's show, which is givemesometruth.info/archives. So anybody who was interested in that issue could listen to the two-hour interview we did with her when she takes us through her website, looking at the photos that she has studied so carefully. And as I say, she pretty much convinced me. I've got a website called www.911nwo.com, NWO, of course, for New World Order, and I feature her work quite a bit. So as I say, she convinced me, and what's so compelling and important to me about that, and I know it's bad, maybe not very productive that different members of the 911 Truth Movement get all bogged down about, you know, the physics of how the buildings came down, and then get stuck on that issue, because that's not the most important issue, but. If indeed the U.S. Military or whoever did the operation demonstrated on that day Tesla-type technology, such as kind of the vaunted death ray of Tesla or something like that, then I think it's reasonable to speculate that this was kind of the unveiling of a new war technology just light years ahead of the nuclear bomb. And that the 911 itself might have been a demonstration of its power, such as, say, the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, so that other countries around the world and their intelligence agencies, which presumably can, you know, kind of read between the lines and see what's really happening, so they are kind of put on notice that, you know, watch out, toe the line, the empire will strike back with this kind of weapon if you don't toe the line.
Well, that's a good argument, and you know, I think it makes a lot of sense. And so, I'll check your website and drjudywood.com. I'll check both of them out. I'm glad people are working on that and focusing on that. I tend not to, and I tend to look on or work on the implications of, you know, these events and where they're going and what they're. Overall military strategy and direction and their goal is, and, you know, the countries they want to gobble up and the people they want to destroy. So I tend to work on that. I'm not saying one is more important than the other. I'm glad we have people that kind of specialize in different areas, because, you know, we all need that from each other.
Bruce, do you feel like that they've followed a lot of what they had mentioned in the Project for a New American Century when they talked about the axis of evil and all the different countries that they had planned?
I can't hear you, Melody.
All the other different countries that they had planned to go into?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think they've really followed through it like a blueprint. And then again, if you look at Zbigniew Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard, it's also another blueprint. And there's another book called Military Space Forces, The Next 50 Years. It's almost 20 years old now. It was a congressional study. So they're planning ahead 50 years at a time in terms of where they're going with space technologies. And it's another blueprint, you know, the Vision for 2020 from the Space Command, another blueprint. So there are many of these documents out there that are available to all of us, and we need to be looking at them so that we get a real clear sense of where they're going, so that we're not fooled when they try to head fake us, you know, and talk about democracy, or, you know, they're protecting women's rights in Afghanistan, or those kind of head fakes. You know, we can't fall for that. You know, we've got to be really on the ball and understand where these people are going and why they're going a particular direction at a particular time.
And don't you feel like, I mean, I'm kind of a little bit behind the eight ball here because I had to pull away from the program a little bit, but we're kind of like the military for the world at this point. When I was listening to some of your videos, it sounds as though, you know, there different countries are going to get different
responsibilities,
and that the U.S. has taken on the military.
Yeah, we're going to be the oil protection service for the resource extraction forces, if you will. You know, so as we see declining water, declining oil, declining gas, declining mineral resources around the world, it's going to be our job in America to be the resource protection service for the corporations. So that means we're going to fight endless wars, and our economy is going to dip down. It's going to be near collapse. There's going to be no economic recovery, because how can there be when we're shipping millions and millions of jobs overseas? What are we going to recover with? And so it's no coincidence today that the number one industrial export product of America is what? What is it?
War.
Yes.
Weapons. Yeah. And when weapons are your number one industrial export product, your global marketing strategy for that product line is war. And so that's what we do. And so we have an economic draft today. We have young people in especially rural communities who have virtually no job prospects. And so they have to join the military. They know, the oligarchy knows, in fact, as the economy worsens, that kids will be lining up because they will have no other possibility for college money, for jobs, or anything else. And so they don't necessarily want to join the military, but they have to. And so their job will be to go and kill people around the world so that we can extract their resources. That's what America is all about today.
Well, let me go ahead.
Just
go ahead and say this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, Colorado, and this is Truth Quest with Melody, and we are streamed on the internet, and our programs are archived at www.givemesometruth.info. And my co-host this evening is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and our special guest is Bruce Gagnon. And I'll let you go ahead and finish what you were saying here.
No, that's okay.
Well, I have a question, Bruce. In talking, it seems like you identify the powers that be as the American Empire. Perhaps as it has been co-opted by a kind of a Nazi ruling aristocracy, would you consider the Anglo-American alliance to be a major power bloc? Would you consider the New World Order to be an international group of oligarchs which transcends national boundaries? I mean, it's always kind of challenging to figure out who's at the head of the monster here. What's your opinion on that?
Well, I think it's the British and the U.S. Banking industries, the oil corporations. I would say they're at the top of it. But yes, and they've had to incorporate more people from around the world in order to get more cooperation from other countries to become junior partners in building the empire. Just one example, Obama was just over in India, and when he went over there on that trip, he took with him a $15 billion weapons deal for Boeing and Lockheed Martin, some of which was space technology too. Now, India, with 450 million poor people, can hardly afford to be moving, getting involved in the U.S. Star Wars program, but they are. We're dragging them into it. They're spending now more and more money getting involved in this program. And the reason why is, number one, because they're buying our product, and that's what we sell anymore. And number two, look at a map, see India's proximity to China. And so as the United States begins its military encirclement of China, India is viewed as another base for the empire. And so this is what's underway. So Obama, once again, shows his loyalty to the oligarchy, to the military-industrial complex, goes over and looks like completes this $15 billion weapons deal, and they're off and running. And China now will have to respond. At the same time, the U.S. is militarily encircling Russia, and some countries are being made junior partners in that program. For example, Poland and the Czech Republic and Albania and Bulgaria, they're being brought into it. Georgia is being brought into it. Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, as NATO is moving into all these countries to encircle Russia, who has the world's largest supply of natural gas. And so Russia must be contained and controlled because of that fact. And so this is one more example of how we are turning the military into this resource extraction arm.
Just to get some figures on this, Bruce, what you mentioned that weapons are our number one product. Do you have a figure as in a monetary value per year on that? Is about $1 trillion or so, isn't it?
I don't have a figure on that, no.
I guess what I've heard is it's $1 trillion worldwide. I don't think the U.S. is making that much, but I don't know.
Well, I know that when you look at, you know, we advertise our annual military budget at $600 to $700 billion a year, but they're not counting the NRO, that's the National Reconnaissance Office, the NSA, they're not counting the Department of Energy that makes nuclear weapons, they're not counting NASA, they're not counting a lot of other programs that are have total military application or marginal military application. So when you add all that up, we're spending $1 trillion a year on the military of our own, let alone on top of that, arms sales to other countries and so it's enormous amount of money.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was my next question: was what our military budget was, and I guess officially it would be somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 or 500 billion a year. But as you say, unofficially, it'd be closer to $1 trillion. Is that right?
Well, it's I think officially up to about 650 billion a year. Cause, wow. And then you know you've got the war supplementals for Afghanistan and Iraq, and it's just an enormous amount of money.
Okay. In terms of the power elite, you mentioned the Nazis. Are there still connections to Germany?
Say that again.
Well, you were talking about the who kind of runs the system. And we talked about the importance of the Nazis right after World War II in kind of directing the course of the American Empire. Is there still a connection back to Germany?
I think so, as to Imperial Japan. I think in all those countries, the industrialists, you know, the IG Farben in Germany and in Japan, some of the leading industrialists that were behind the Japanese Imperial War effort, they remained in power, you know, after the wars were over. We didn't take them down, you know. They were industrial allies with American industry in many respects. So those guys still are around, and their ambitions for global control I think, have been morphed into what we now call corporate globalization, or, as you called it earlier, the New World Order. It's all the same thing. And so, yeah, I think that all over the world, these huge mega industrialists are part of this whole program. They're benefiting from it. They're part of the core of the operation, if you will, and you know, they're making big money off the whole program.
So how would you say that the New World Order or the corporate globalization core will differ from, say, the old world order or the present world order?
Well, you know, I guess in the go back to World War II, you know, it was more individual countries, you know, Germany and Italy against, you know, everybody else kind of thing. Well, now it's not quite like that. Now it's well, go by. I'd like to go back to this guy Thomas Barnett that I referred to earlier, that was identified as Donald Rumsfeld's strategy guy. He wrote a book called The Pentagon's New Map, and he laid out what the U.S.'s role under corporate globalization was going to be. He said that there's part of the world that is what he called today the non-integrating gap, GAP, the non-integrating gap. And these are the folks that are not submitting to the authority of corporate globalization. And they tend to be in the Middle East and Central Asia and Africa and parts of Latin America. Particularly, he's talking about Venezuela, where Hugo Chavez isn't surrendering to the demands of the U.S. and British oil corporations. And so Barnett says America's role in the future will be to go into this non-integrating gap and enforce compliance with corporate globalization. And so that's why we're in Iraq today. That's why we're in Afghanistan and Pakistan. That's why the U.S. has now created the Africa Command. The Pentagon has created AFRICOM to go in and begin to take control of Africa. And that we're destabilizing Venezuela through our operations in Colombia and otherwise. So the way I see it is that the elites in the so-called industrialized countries largely have consolidated agreement about how things are going to work. They're going to control the resources. They're going to make the money. The people will be increasingly brought down to a level of feudalism, what I call 21st century feudalism, and that those that resist this, people like Russia or Iran or, you know, Venezuela or, you know, Afghanistan or other countries will be devastated by what Barnett called Leviathan. He said, because of space technology, there's really no distinction between the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines anymore. He said, it's really all coordinated, all one military operation now because of space technology. And so he says, we're essentially going to have two services in the future. One, Leviathan, to do shock and awe like we did in Iraq in 2003. And to go in with a devastating initial attack and just blow the hell out of everybody. And he says, we're very good at that, and no one can stand against us. And I think that's true. He said, but where we're having problems is what he calls systems administration. After you've gone in with Leviathan and you blow everybody up, then you have to run the country. And he says, we're not doing a very good job of that in Iraq or Afghanistan. And so today, Lockheed Martin is receiving hundreds of millions of dollars, probably billions of dollars in contracts to train systems administrators that Thomas Barnett said will never come home. So after we go in and attack a country, we'll make them a colony by sending in systems administration And these troops, Barnett says, will never come home. And so that means the bases in Iraq, the bases in Afghanistan, the bases that we've already begun to establish bases in Pakistan, these troops will never come home. That's the plan. That's their goal.
Bruce, are you familiar with Hegelian dialectic? That term?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay, because when you're mentioning the fact that these troops, these administrators go into these countries and never come home, it maybe they're not failing as they appear. I mean, if they're trying to have continuous war, would it not be a means to keep the war going by appearing to be failing, and the Hegelian dialectic being used as the argument? Eric, you want to?
You're doing well. I think you're absolutely right. I call it chaos theory
or creative destruction.
Yeah, you create so much chaos. It's like, you remember in Iraq when everybody was looting everything and our soldiers were standing by and watching it, except, you know, the Ministry of Oil was not looted, you know. So they allowed this chaos to happen because it then gave the justification, as you just well stated, for our ongoing operation. And I can't tell you how many quote-unquote liberals I've heard over the years say, well, we can't leave now. Yes, we shouldn't have gone in there, but now it's such a mess, we can't leave it now. We have to stay and fix it. And that's exactly the response they wanted people to have, absolutely.
Well, that's the term, you know, insanity, when you keep trying to do the same thing over and over again and it doesn't work.
Well, but it is working.
It is, right.
If you look at it, and again, this is what we don't do enough. We have to be able to see through the eyes of these people. We have to see where they're going. We have to see what their plan is. Then we can talk about it. Then we can help the American people translate it. See, the American people have become so misled and brainwashed by the corporate media and the two political parties that pretend we have a democracy, the people are a little confused, and they don't have confidence anymore in translating all of these things. And so if we understand it better and can see it more clearly, see it through the eyes of this oligarchy, then we can translate it better. I like to think of putting pieces of the puzzle on the wall so everyone can begin to see what the picture really is. And then you can begin to deal with it, because people have a new consciousness. They become liberated. They become liberated from their mental colonization.
Well, if we look at them as corporations instead of these countries, or then maybe we might be able to see a little bit more and understand more of what they're after and how they work. They're amoral, and since it is a military-industrial complex, which means it's a corporate structure in its own right. If we can kind of separate it out and realize this has been kind of like a hostile takeover, and that they're getting rid of the assets and treating it in that light, to me it makes much more sense.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, Bruce, what do you see as the goal of the oligarchs? You mentioned that, you know, America is supposed to be kind of the military enforcer and the controller of resources. But for the average person, you mentioned it'd be kind of more of a feudalistic sort of system. It would appear there's a deliberate attempt to destroy the middle class and bring us back to third world status. The Kyoto Protocol type laws would certainly result in a massive phase out of our use of fossil fuels, and they're depriving us of our wealth as well as our energy. We hear talk of FEMA camps. We hear lots about Agenda 21. What do you think that the role is to just take America down Or do you think the role is to so transform America that America cannot be the superpower that it once was? Or what do you think the role of America is supposed to be?
Well, I think the earlier comment about, you know, the corporations being the be-all and end-all is really the right direction to go, because the corporations don't care about country anymore. They're beyond country. That's the New World Order. That's corporate globalization. The corporations are now king. They're God. And so they don't really care about country anymore. They care about maximizing profits internationally. That's what they care about. They care about controlling resources. They want to thin out the population. There's too many people because of robotics and computerization and technology. They don't need so many people anymore. And so we have literally superfluous populations as far as they're concerned around the world. So the more war and the more disease and the more poverty, and I mean, look what's happening in Haiti and how the governments have really done almost nothing to help the people of Haiti, who are now living in tents, and now they're catching diseases because of the way they're living, because they've been utterly neglected by the world, and they're going to have a massive die-off, and they don't really care. The governments don't care because those are superfluous people, and so it's going to be that way all over the world. So I think the goal is to literally take us down, but to bleed us dry at the same time, to take every last dollar they can out of our hides and use that to build this military infrastructure that is then used to enforce this corporate globalization plan across the planet. We are just tools. So we're going to see the destruction of public education. We're going to see that it's going to become virtually impossible for working class and poor children to go on to higher education, because there's not going to be any way that anybody other than rich kids are going to get higher education, except for a few exceptional bright students that will be brought in to work as functionaries for the system. So that's their plan. I always like to, you know, kind of qualify all of this to say this is their plan. I'm not predicting they're going to be successful ultimately in carrying it out, because what we know from human history is that now and then the people do rise up. Now and then there is an intervening moment. Every plan for domination has an Achilles heel. And in this case, the Achilles heel is their desire to reduce us to a feudal system. Already we're seeing backlash in this country. The Tea Party is one example of working class and middle class people being angry, being a little confused, being not clear as to what can be done, and then being utterly co-opted by the big money from the corporations, trying to steer them off into the arms of the right wing. But still, those Tea Party people will soon find out that the Republicans controlling the House and the Republicans controlling my state now in Maine, we went from a Democratic-controlled state with a Democratic governor and a Democrat House and Senate in Maine to now all Republican in Maine. And guess what? They're not going to be able to fix anything, because there's no money. There's no money in Maine, and there's no money going to come from the federal government. In fact, the federal government is going to even provide less money for the state of Maine. And so they can create the most business-friendly environment in the world here in Maine, and there's still not going to be any real investment here, any real recovery, because that's not the plan. And so the people then, the Tea Party type people, will sooner or later begin to see it. Now, we organized in Maine. I'm a member of Veterans for Peace in Maine. We began on election night a walk from Farmington to Portland, more than 125-mile walk through 43 different communities where we were talking about the cost of war. And in every community, we got major media coverage, and we got really good response from the public. Literally tens of thousands and thousands of cars driving by as we walked for a week through the state of Maine. And we began this on election night because we wanted to make the statement that no matter who won the elections, there was going to be no real change to our economy until we end these wars. And we were over and over again talking about how much these wars are costing each and every one of these 43 towns. We had the figures for each town as we walked through them, and we made that known in the media. And so this is the real agenda right now for the peace movement in America, is to connect the dots, help the public see that this is the plan and that these wars are destroying our economy, and that we've got to end them and demand that, and help move people's consciousness into a positive direction so that we can begin to deal with all of this, and also deal with our real problem, which is climate change. We've got to deal with climate change if we hope to survive on this planet, and we're not going to deal with it by spending $8 billion a month in Afghanistan. So,
well, now just a second here, Bruce. I teach climatology, and my career as a physical geographer is looking at paleoclimate, and I've got a website, as Melody said, called naturalclimatechange.us, and I know there is a wide perception which has been, I think, promoted by the media and by the IPCC and by the UN that humans have damaged the climate and we need to fix it. But I really genuinely would ask you to look at my website and look at the other side. What we have seen in the 20th century vis-a-vis past climate change of the Earth is nothing. Is nothing out of the ordinary at all. I think that the research now has shown that humans it's cooled since 1998 for one thing. We're dealing with solar cycles. We're dealing with climate cycles. So this is not a problem, but I think that it has been used and is still being used to advance the agenda of the corporatocracy, and there's many elements of that. But I will say that I think I heard good news in my climatology class when one of my students brought up the fact that the Chicago Climate Exchange, which was founded by Marie Strong of the UN and was set to make hundreds of billions and even trillions of dollars trading carbon credits, is now folded. And this is because the Obama administration has not been able to pass a Climate Security Act, which would have put regulations in place that would have, mandated carbon taxes and cap and trade and this kind of thing. This, from my point of view, and I've done a lot of research on this, this is another way to take down the American economy and another Ponzi scheme for Goldman Sachs and Wall Street and the corporatocracy. Yeah. So yes, we have problems, and the problems, I think, are mainly the incredible disparity between the wealthy and everybody else, and the fact that the economy has been looted by these people, and I totally agree about the war issue and the military-industrial complex. But climate change is something that humans have always adapted to. We will always have to adapt to it. That's what climate does. That's my rep.
Well, that's fine, and we each can have our opinions. But I have to tell you, I tend to form a lot of my opinions based on my own personal experience, and my experience living in Maine the last 8 years. Maine has had a traditional kind of weather pattern in the summer. That's why people love to come here on vacation. It's usually cool in the low 70s, and it's a very pleasant place to be when other places are very hot. Well, this year we had the hottest recorded summer in Maine in history. It was absolutely miserable. It felt like where I used to live for 30 years in Florida, hot and humid for months on end. And so clearly something is happening. I also believe that I mean, I do a lot of street protests, you know, for many, many years. And so I've sucked in a lot of exhaust on the street, and I know it's not doing my lungs any good. And I also know that you can't eat the fish in Maine anymore because of acid rain from our polluting industrial base. So I know that humankind is in fact affecting the environment in a negative way. And so what I would like to see is, rather than us building weapons for endless war, I would like to see us build a solar society. I would like to see us build public transportation to get us out of our gas-guzzling and polluting cars that we have to go to war for oil to fill up our tanks. And so I think that there can be a cleaning up, if you will, of the way we live on this planet if we were to develop some new technologies and some old technologies. Rail's been around a long time.
I agree with you on that. And I just think that the whole climate change issue has been taken out of the realm of science and put into the realm of religion. Now, in terms of what's happened in the last 8 years, I think it's possible. I would speculate that some of the abnormalities may be indeed imposed by humans, but it wouldn't be our burning of fossil fuels. It would be something more in the order of HAARP or the Air Force and the weather modification capabilities that we now seem to have, even though they are covert. So I think that it well could be that some of the extreme climate we're seeing could be man-made, but man-made by the military.
Eric, isn't part of the sun cycle come into this factor into this too?
Well, we are now. I think we're into solar cycle 24, and since they've started counting about 24 cycles ago. In terms of the actual satellite measurements of the atmosphere of the world, the Earth's average temperature has been declining since 1998 and declining fast since 2007. It's very difficult to get an average temperature of the world, and it may not even be meaningful. Certainly locally we see some extreme weather. In the past, you know, you're always going to see hurricanes and extreme weather somewhere. That's really another subject. But I think that we can do better in terms of cleaning up our environment, in terms of less pollution in the air and the water. What I'm starting to really get concerned about is all these covert activities which are occurring in our skies that Congress and the military are not telling us about. Now, we don't know what they're doing to our weather. It could be we've had abnormal. We had a record 113 degrees in Los Angeles in late September, and that's unheard of. Who knows what's behind that? You know.
The reality is that for some people in parts of Western Africa, or some people on small islands in the Pacific, the rising of the sea levels is real. Okay, I don't claim to be an expert, and I don't claim to know all the reasons why sea levels are rising. It could be, as you say, very well could be partly caused by weather modification. I wouldn't doubt it.
I have to stop you there, Bruce. If you go to the experts, and I'm talking about the people who've studied sea level all their lives, they would say there is no increase in sea level by human activity. We've seen about a 6-inch a century rise in sea level since the culmination of the Little Ice Age about 1750. And we have not seen that really accelerate, maybe 7 inches. So what we're getting is a lot of propaganda. We're getting a lot of misinformation. Sea levels are hard to track because there are coasts that are tectonically active, some of which are rising, some of which are falling. So it's very difficult, again, to get an average sea level of the whole world. But no, this is just like the polar bears and the ice is melting. These are the whole series of propaganda ploys that each of, and the insects and the mosquitoes, all this Al Gore movie stuff is a bunch of hooey. And it's fear, and it's control through fear, and it's not real. And to the extent that people buy into that, they're buying into pseudoscientific propaganda. And again, if you want to, you know, check it out, go to the people who've studied these things all their lives, and I would count myself as one of them. The press, this is coming out of the BBC, lots coming out of all aspects of the media. You know, there's more melting of the ice than we thought, the sea level's rising faster than, all this is coming out of computer models for the most part.
Except I'm talking about people's real experience. There are, as I said, people living in West Africa and people living in the Pacific Islands, and the fact of the matter is the place where they've been living, and many cases for a long, long time, are now being covered with water. That's a fact. Okay.
I'm not sure about that. You'd have to convince me of who those people are and where it is.
Okay.
So, Bruce,
I think what you're dealing with is misinformation, and the press is systematic about giving us.
Okay. Well, let's disagree on that and move on to something else.
Bruce, I wanted to ask you about it. Are you finding out that there's a lot of backlash within the military over this warfare as being such an ongoing situation?
Well, of course there is, and I think the best indicator of that is the number of suicides that are being committed by GIs today. In the year 2009, there were more people that, more GIs committed suicide than were killed in Afghanistan. It's now more than one a day are killing themselves. So the fact is that, as I said earlier, a lot of these young people, probably most of these young people, are going into the military because it's a jobs program for them. They have really very few other options other than maybe flipping burgers at McDonald's, but how many people can really work there? So they're seeing their friends come back from Iraq and Afghanistan with these massive trauma injuries, brain trauma injuries. So they don't want to go. They see friends coming back from 2, 3, 4, and 5 deployments overseas, and they're coming back with PTSD and severe mental problems as a result of these deployments. So there are all these things happening, and the troops really are absolutely in a state of shock and despair about these wars. But unfortunately, the American people are not coming to their defense. You know, people talk about support the troops. We need to support the troops. Well, they're not. They're not supporting the troops. They're putting them over and over again into these situations. There are all these suicides that are happening, and there's very little discussion on the part of the American people about these wars. When we just had this recent national election, there was virtually no discussion about the fact we're spending $8 billion a month in Afghanistan. None of the politicians from either party were talking about that war. The people were not talking about that war. The American people now in polls are saying that about, you know, when they list their priorities, the top issues that they're most concerned about, the war in Afghanistan comes in at about 2 or 3%, and the top issue being jobs. And so, again, this is where the peace movement, I think, has done a bad job, where we should have been working harder in recent years to link the war spending to the loss of jobs in this country. And I think we have to really rebound on in this area and do a much better effort in the coming period.
As I understand it, you worked some with Helen Caldicott. Is that correct, or did I?
Yeah, I've known her for some years. In 1997, NASA launched a space probe with 72 pounds of plutonium on it called Cassini, and we organized, I was living in Florida at the time, we organized quite an international campaign to oppose it. She came to Florida because she's always been interested in nuclear power issues. She came to Florida for several days to assist us. It was the first time I really got to know her. And during that time, as I was driving her around to different speaking venues we set up for her, I was talking to her about the wider space issue, and that's really the first time she began to really hear in a deeper way about all the plans for the militarization of space. She went on to write a book about it, and so since that time we've become good friends, and we've worked together on many different occasions.
So when the troops are exposed to the, do you deal with the issue on the depleted uranium at all?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. And I mean, I've interviewed Doug Rocky. Are you familiar with him?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how they're being exposed, and I have to wonder if some of these, suicides that are being attributed to the troops could possibly be more than just that, if some of them are refusing to follow through with certain orders. Have you run across that sort of issue at all?
I haven't, but I do believe that it's very possible, probably very likely, that some of the suicides are of people that are coming back and feeling quite ill because of exposure to DU. I have a friend in Florida, a woman who was in the Army and was in the Gulf War, the Persian Gulf War, in the 90s. And you might remember the famous highway of death as the Saddam Hussein's people were driven out of Kuwait and they were driving back to Iraq. The U.S. came in and just bombed the famous, long line of convoys as they were trying to get back to Iraq. She was on a team of about a dozen soldiers that were sent in to take the bodies out of all those vehicles. She took a lot of pictures. She's created a little booklet about it. Most of those people were burnt to a crisp, and when they went in to reach for them to take them out of vehicles, many of them just crumbled as dust. And when she came home, she brought her uniform and a jar of sand for her son, who was very young at the time. And he would wear the uniform and he would play with the sand. And within a few years, he died of a brain aneurysm. She became very ill, and to this day, she has multiple health problems. She's in a wheelchair. She cannot walk. She has just so many problems. And she's the only person in her little squad that is still alive today. It's quite clear that she was exposed and contaminated by depleted uranium.
And
everyone else in her squad has died from it, and her own son likely died from secondary exposure to the depleted uranium from her clothing and from the sand she brought home from that war.
Yeah, you were saying that you was on a march with vets. Did they speak about their inability to get the proper kind of health care?
Well, none of the vets on this particular peace walk were from
that era.
Time. Okay. They're mostly Vietnam vets and Korean War vets. But you know, I've recently seen a lot of pictures coming out of Fallujah in Iraq of deformed children that are being born as a result of the carnage that happened in that city at the hands of the U.S. military, and clearly depleted uranium was the weapon of choice in that particular carnage. So there's no doubt about it that it's essentially a nuclear bomb has been dropped over Iraq, and the consequences are going to be with us for virtually forever.
Yeah, they report that the half-life is 4.5 billion years. Well, that itself is the life of the planet so far. So, like you say, virtually forever. It's hard to get your mind, it's hard for me to get my mind around a military strategy that would use material like that in a place that they did not want to destroy forever. As you say, Iraq would be a resource-producing area, and yet if they used 320 tons of the stuff in the 1991 war, and then they used, whatever, 10 times more than that in the 2003 war, aren't they essentially making it uninhabitable?
Yeah, and, you know, the only conclusion I can come to is that they want to clear the population out. But then, the counter argument is, well, but then how are they going to go in and, you know, run the oil fields when the place is totally contaminated? I can't really answer it, that question at that point. And I must say the where I go next in my mind is it just goes to show how absolutely insane these people are. Absolutely insane. For whatever reason, whatever their motivation is, the fact that they have done this to the Iraqi people, to American soldiers, to the planet, just shows the sheer insanity of these people. And if for no other reason, the American people should be up in arms and throwing every one of these people responsible for making these decisions in prison for the rest of their lives, because this is the ultimate crime against humanity. It's genocide. It is genocide worse even than the genocide that Hitler did to the Jews.
Do you
Well, it's ecocide as well as genocide, because it's not only humans that are affected.
That's right, exactly.
Bruce, have you followed any of the naval testing that they're doing along our coastlines? Are you familiar with any of that?
A little bit I am.
Okay, and how that they're able to use a lot of weapons and chemicals that would be detrimental to mammals,
mm-hmm.
and which again flies in the face of them coming back and saying that we're not allowed to utilize certain areas because of certain animals that we might disturb. Do you see some kind of contradictory hypocrisy going on in the environmental movement, and being tied to the like in the military situations?
Well, I will say in general, I'm very disappointed in the environmental movement. I wish they would get off their knees. I think the environmental movement has suffered from too close of a relationship to politicians over the years. You know, every Earth Day, politicians from either party like to get in canoes and get their picture taken, and, you know, they plant a tree and that kind of thing. And the environmental movement, because of their proximity to these politicians, they think that they've developed a relationship and that they can count on them. So they're a little reluctant to be very critical of things like wars and ecocide, thank you for that, and such things. And they really are now finding that their relationship with the politicians wasn't so great after and so close after all, because they're getting basically screwed on every front, on every issue that they try to advance on. So I think the environmental movement really is is and you know, and I consider myself an environmentalist. I mean, you know, I'm sad to say it, but I just think that it's an example of a movement that has been taken over by the political system, by the political elites, and run into the ground.
I agree with that, and we've had the opportunity to interview Joan Vion before, and she, I think, is pretty good about talking about the new face of fascism in America, which is called a public-private partnership, and that involves a kind of a three-way triangle, cooperation, collusion between government, corporations, and NGOs, where the NGOs, such as the Sierra Club or the National Resource Defense Council or whatever, plays a very critical role in advancing the corporatocracy's agenda. So I think it's as you say, only maybe more so in the sense that these big environmental groups, their boards have been totally infiltrated by the same people that sit on the boards of the military-industrial complex, so they become part of the system.
Well, you know, it wasn't long after Obama became president. I saw an article. It was either in the New York Times or the Washington Post. I can't remember now which one. And it told a story about how every morning Rahm Emanuel, the White House chief of staff for Obama, was sending out talking points to all of the key constituencies of various groups, peace groups, women's groups, environmental groups, etc. And they were expected to toe the administration line on particular issues on a particular day. And the story went on to say that if any of them got frisky and rebelled and, you know, tried to be critical of the administration in any way, Rahm Emanuel would just get on the phone and call their foundation donors and have them defunded.
There you go.
And so absolutely we're seeing that the, kind of the professionalization of nonprofit organizations has led to this reliance on these foundations, which generally tend, you know, progressive foundations generally tend to be supportive of the Democratic Party. They're rich people. They tend to, you know, be linked to the Democratic Party. And so they're easily influenced by the administration's line, and so they can, you know, one phone call can very quickly, you know, silence people if they want to keep their jobs. And so, very early on in the show, I talked about how Obama had demobilized the left, and I think this example is one particular strategy that was used to, in fact, demobilize the left, as Obama then went on to create programs that were against the interest of the people that voted for him, by and large, and that were interests that were allied to the corporate interests that funded his campaign. You know, it's important to remember that Barack Obama got more campaign donation money from the military-industrial complex than John McCain did in that last presidential election.
It's as though they're tag-teaming us. In other words, one comes in and plays one part of the agenda, and then the other side comes in and plays the other part of the agenda as we advance forward into this, what you say, New World Order or corporatocracy. Do you agree?
I think so. Tag team, it's a good it's a good description.
Your story about Rahm Emanuel is very interesting. I hadn't heard that, but I was aware of the fact that under Bush, too, many Republican congressmen or their staff would go to weekly meetings of Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Reform, and they would get their talking points for the week.
Yeah.
So apparently and of course this is why the Republicans could so consistently vote along straight party lines, you know, as if they have one single boss telling everybody what to do. It would appear that the Democrats learned the same tactic. So in a sense, no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans.
Yeah, but in the end, though, they suffered because they've now lost the House and lost significant seats in the Senate because of the so-called enthusiasm gap. And this was the, you know, the outcome, the expected outcome, one that I predicted immediately after Obama's election. In fact, in my blog, I predicted that this would happen as he began betraying various constituencies, because, you know, people saw what was going on, and they lost confidence in the Democrats. The Democrats, you know, basically got back into power because they ran against Bush's wars. That was the horse they rode back into power. And then when they got into power, they took, they got off the horse, they put it in the barn, they locked the door to the barn, and then they went and voted along the same lines and continued Bush's wars. And now, as we see with Obama, expanding the war in Afghanistan and into Pakistan. So the Democrats completely betrayed their constituency. And so now people are beginning to figure it out. And a lot of people are brokenhearted, but a lot of people are also really angry about it and are beginning to finally have some discussions about maybe we've got to get off this train. You know, we've got to step off this train that is run with the engine with one party and the caboose with the other. And like you said, they just switch places from time to time.
Well, don't you feel like we're just being played by the party system? Because ultimately, if they're not really running this, if this is a military-industrial complex and it's a corporatocracy, so
yeah, we're being played. I think that the assassination of President Kennedy was a coup d'état, and since that time, every president has had to be selected by the CIA, basically, and the oligarchy who run this country. You know, I think of Bill Clinton, who was a governor in Arkansas, and a friend of mine in Arkansas, a leading activist there for many years, used to publish a statewide newspaper, progressive newspaper, and he told me they covered the whole story. You remember the Iran-Contra scandal and the drugs for weapons,
right.
Running in, you know, selling drugs and then buying weapons, and Ollie North's operation out of the White House and running that through little tiny airports in rural America, flying the drugs in or weapons into you know, to the Contras in Nicaragua. Well, they were flying out of Mena, Arkansas, at a tiny little rural airport, and the county prosecutor built a case, but he didn't have the money to prosecute, you know, basically the federal government and the CIA. So he went to the governor, Clinton, and he said, look, I got these guys dead in the water, but I need your help. I need the state to help me, you know, pay for this, and we can take them down. And Clinton said, oh, yeah, great, fine. Go home, and I'll get right back to you. Well, Clinton never called the guy back. Instead, what he basically did was called George Herbert Walker Bush on the phone, and they made a deal. You look the other way, and we'll give you a shot at becoming president of the United States of America. And that's what happened. And that's the way they run things in America today.
So it's kind of like a mafia gangs or a criminal elite.
Syndicate.
Yes.
Yeah, it is. It's a criminal syndicate. That's who controls this country today.
Actually, I think it's
no arguments there. and indeed the world.
We're not going to disagree on that one.
Oh, no.
No, I wanted to bring up something here. I rewatched Carnicom.com's movie on chemtrails. He's got a very interesting section. It's a long movie. He put it out in 2005, I think. But he put up his website, Carnicom.com. This is a guy from New Mexico who's a former government employee who started looking at the sky and asking questions. And after he got his website up in early 1999, he started observing was going to his website and taking a look at it. And he printed out the list of the entities that were hitting on his website. And I'll just read a few of them. He's got like over 100 of them here. Lockheed Martin, Los Alamos National Laboratory, Allergan Pharmaceutical Corporation, Alliant Tech Systems, Raytheon Defense Systems, Boeing Aircraft Company, United States Defense Logistics, Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, Department of Defense Naval Computer, U.S. Navy Sea Systems Command, Western Pacific Region of the Federal, blah, 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 NASA, Environmental Protection Agency, St. Vincent Hospital, Santa Fe, New Mexico, Headquarters, United States Army, Navy, Senate, Congress, every element of the military-industrial complex with the government is in this list of 129 people who showed an interest in his fledgling website in 1999. Isn't that interesting?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, gentlemen, I think it's to the point where we need to kind of draw this to a close, and I also want to thank you, Bruce, for coming on our program.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
It's very interesting to get your perspectives, Bruce. I appreciate it. You're a deep thinker, and you're an activist, and that's something that we sure need in this country, and so I appreciate your joining us, and I appreciate your perspectives and your efforts. I'm looking forward to looking at some of these materials that you recommended.
Okay. Good night to you all, and best of luck to all your listeners.
Okay, and I hope we can do it again. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, this has been Truth Quest with Melody, and I've got a few PSAs that I've got to read, and that was Bruce Gagnon and my co-host, Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and it got to be quite a lively discussion on several issues, and I'm glad that we get a chance to look at some of the different sides of these issues as much as like climate change. And again, I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHIN staff, volunteers, and board of directors. And this is KHEN LP 106.9 Salida.